Welcome to the Sexual Mindfulness Project podcast, where we talk about creating an intentional relationship and how to find joy in slowing down, letting go of judgment, and connecting more deeply with your partner. I am delighted to be here today with Sharon and Chelsea Maxwell, a mother and daughter team who I think are going to really enlighten us on a number of topics. First, I just want to start off with an introduction, letting the two of you introduce yourselves.
I'm Sharon Maxwell. I'm a clinical psychologist. I've been seeing adolescents and families, young adults for probably 35 years now. I have a book called The Talk. And it has to do with children and talking to children about sex. And we can obviously talk more about that. I've been very fortunate that worked in the area of teaching parents how to talk to kids about sex in a healthy, responsible way. My daughter decided to become part of this, and she can tell you why and her story. And we can tell you a little bit more about how the whole thing got started. But basically, clinical psychologist and author and lecturer, mom, new grandma, I must say.
Wow, that's a lot of roles.
A lot of roles.
And I'm Chelsea Maxwell. Growing up with a mom who talked about sex, I definitely never thought that this is what I would be doing. But when I was in college, I started studying domestic violence, and I became very interested in how to proactively talk with young people about what is a healthy relationship. And I saw that this was a missing piece in a lot of sex education courses. And I began working with my mom and her course that she was already teaching to kind of build out that element of how to talk to young people about healthy relationships. In that work, I began to get much more interested in all of the different components of talking to young people about sex because I saw what an enormous need there was. I would have young people my age in their 20s and 30s coming to me because they knew I taught sex ed, asking very basic questions about their own anatomy or different questions about sex. So I saw the need, and I then went to get my master's of education at Harvard to really focus on building out the work that we're doing.
That's wonderful. Thank you. I'm so fascinated by this idea that we kind of fragment these topics of sexuality, don't we? And we talk about sexual violence, the whole Me Too movement with that happening right now. I think maybe we're getting a reminder that we've got to start back at the basics, right? We've got to make sure people have a thorough understanding of just what is healthy sexuality.
And with the internet, before I ever started talking about sex or writing about talking to kids about sex, I was very influenced by the fact that a lot of my patients were shifting how they understood themselves and how they understood the world around them and how they understood themselves as young people becoming sexual people based on their interaction with the internet. And this is prior to Snapchat and a lot of the social apps that are now out there influencing how kids form relationships, how they understand intimacy. And it became really clear that it was having a profound effect on human development, on just childhood development. I wanted to write a book about that, but of course nobody was interested. This was back in the early 2000s and nobody was really interested in that. So I decided to look at that through the lens of how we become sexual people and what we need to talk about with regard to sex. And I think they're very interconnected. You can't really have a good sexual health curriculum, which we have and we take around the country and actually internationally at this point, but you can't really talk about it unless you're willing to talk about social media and internet pornography, all of that. If you don't include all of that, you're right. We segmented it into so many different parts that children are just confused. They need a whole cloth approach that really talks about all of those aspects.
So if you were to talk about just a few of the important elements of children interacting with social media, the internet, what would your guidance be?
We have a whole 5-hour curriculum we do with students on the internet.
We might have to shorten that just a little here.
That curriculum also includes 2 hours with parents. So there's a lot to be said about that topic.
Which is such an important aspect at teaching both the parents and the child.
Has to do both.
Yeah.
Without the other. And the same is true with our sexual health curriculum. We'll not go into a school and do our sexual health curriculum unless they will give us 2 hours with the parents because they need to know. And we send the children home to ask their parents questions during the curriculum. So the parents understand that ethical behavior and what they believe, and people can have a variety of beliefs, which is fine with us, but the parent, it's their job to convey what those beliefs are to the child and follow it up with reasons why.
Yeah. And with regards to your question, I think if there was one thing, you know, we work with a lot of organizations that support parents in delaying access to smartphones and social media. And that's really important. And you can delay and delay it, and eventually they are going to get it. And it's so important. Right now, we have a whole course called Driver's Ed for Smartphones. And we need to be educating our children before they get the smartphones, as we're slowly unrolling different access to social media and all that comes with that communication and information and entertainment. We need to be educating them in what this really is, how they can be prepared for what's going to be coming at them.
And how they're being manipulated. I mean, particularly when you're talking to teens for 30 some odd years, the one thing that will get their attention is if you tell them they're being manipulated. There's no kind of manipulation as profound and as psychologically powerful as the manipulation of social media. And unless you instruct them as to how that's happening, simply wagging your finger and telling them it's the end of the world is not going to do the trick. You have to actually give them real ideas about how they're being manipulated and what they can do to keep themselves from being manipulated.
Yeah. And I think we're learning more and more about that just in the last few years, about how this manipulation is possibly quite intentional. I love this idea of rolling out these ideas one by one so they can kind of learn a little mastery as they go and the parent can see how they're responding.
Exactly.
I love that. Let me ask you this question. What advice do you have for parents who want to share their values about sex with their children, but they themselves feel uncomfortable talking about sex?
Yeah. We hear this everywhere we go. The most important thing to remember is no matter what you say, you're going to do a better job than porn. I mean, I think it's just so important for parents to know that you don't need to find the perfect words. Of course, we always recommend that parents talk with friends or partners, practice what you're going to say, reflect on what you wish you had known as a child, do that work. My mom's book has a lot of information on really step-by-step how to approach those conversations with your kids. But just really knowing whatever you say, the research shows talking to your kids about sex will delay first sexual experiences. So it's going to do a better job than what they're going to find online. And if you're not talking to them, they're going to be looking for that information somewhere else. And we also encourage parents to just be honest with your kids. If you're feeling uncomfortable, you can tell them, you know, my parents never did a good job talking to me about this. Maybe they never talked to me about this. And I want to do a better job with you. So I might not always have the perfect answers, but if I need to think more about it, we'll schedule a time to talk more about it. But I really care that I do a better job with you.
I like that you're just kind of setting yourself up for being a little vulnerable with your child on a very intimate topic, where vulnerability is kind of necessary. So just saying, I'm not the perfect authority on this, but let's start a discussion.
Exactly. And then keep the discussion going. The media provides countless ways of keeping that conversation going, you know, and every time when you hear something to say, well, what do you, or you're watching a television show, well, what do you think? Why do you think she chose to have sex right then? What do you think he was thinking when they made that decision? You know, how is it that people make decisions about this? You know, kids get no information other than what they see on TV or what they see on their smartphones. And that's horrifying to me. I mean, one of the things we talk about when we're talking to kids and also when we're talking to parents is like, can you imagine being an alien from outer space and dropping down onto the earth and watching how human beings talk about everything? We talk about everything. But when it comes to sex, we do not. When it comes to parents talking to kids about that, I mean, nutrition and exercise and, you know, doing your homework, all the things that you want to tell them, we tell them nothing about sex, assuming they're going to just figure it out. But what they're doing is they're just watching porn. You know, if I had a dime for every child that's come into my office after having had sex and is disappointed or confused or, you know, and I'm like, well, you know, they were just copying what they saw in porn and wondering why it wasn't a satisfying experience for them. Yeah, there's a lot to say about porn and all of this.
Right. And how porn really just, again, fragments the whole experience of sexuality just into physical. There's no real understanding of the emotional dynamics that are happening or the relational dynamics.
Yeah. And as well as the fact that when you are masturbating to porn, which is the only reason for porn, you know, you are disassociating. It's all in your mind. It's all in your imagination, which is fine. But there is a lot of issues that are coming up with young men, particularly being okay having sex because they have developed such a habit of masturbation to a particular visual stimulus. They've wired their brain in a particular way. And I will get these young men in, and when they're having their first sexual experience, everything's not working properly. And they're freaking out and thinking this is a terrible thing. But in fact, what's happened is they've just wired themselves for years, you know, to a particular kind of stimulation. And now they really don't understand. Also, they have no understanding of there being another person involved. This has been a completely one in my own head experience. It's a very different kind of experience when you're with another human being. And really all the, you know, you have to take away the fear and the anxiety first and say, no, you just have to stop masturbating to porn for a while. You know, you have to like give your mind a break and like rewire yourself to actually have a human experience. And this isn't just kids. These are, you know, adult men and that also have the same issues. So I think it's a conversation that no parent wants to have, but it's an important conversation. Like, how are you learning about human interaction, intimacy, and sexuality if that is your sex ed, which is what, if you don't provide sex ed, that is sex ed. Yeah. It's an important thing for parents to hear.
Yeah. And it, like you're saying, it kind of handicaps them. They don't really understand the nuances of a relationship and pleasing a partner and interacting with a partner, even if it's a great relationship. That's going to be difficult to do if your example is just porn.
Exactly. I don't know if we answered the question. We got sidetracked onto porn. I'm not sure if we...
Yeah. So maybe, let's go back to that. Parents who maybe feel uncomfortable. I feel like you did talk about whatever you say is better than what porn is going to teach.
Yeah. I think that pretty much covered it.
I mean, okay. I really say that it's also important. It's not a talk. The book is called The Talk. That was because the editor, publisher wanted insisted that be it. But it's not one talk. It's an ongoing conversation. It's much better to have like little bite-sized conversations. And it's not a one-way talk. It is a conversation.
It's a talk that lasts their whole life.
they're listening even though they're acting like they're not, or acting like they don't want to. They're still listening to you. And you're probably the only, you know, caring adult that they're getting any information from. So, you know, it's a very important conversation to have continuously.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You bring up the point that, you know, some kids act like they're indifferent to this conversation on sexuality. And some may even resist, like, you know, oh, can we please just never talk about this? But what would your suggestion be to kind of encouraging our children to start feeling comfortable with this conversation?
Yeah, that's the other question we always get. What do I do? My kids won't listen when I talk about sex. I always share about my experience. I was totally mortified every time my mom would mention it. I would never, you know, want to talk about it. It would never have come from me initiating it, but she'd say, you know, the conversations were both built into stories we saw on a television show, and we'd have a dialogue afterwards, and I'd roll my eyes and say, why do you have to ruin every show we watch? But I was hearing the messages and the values were coming through. And then also conversations where she'd say, we need to talk. I need to share something with you that is important for you to know. And I'd roll my eyes. I'd say, I know this, you've told me everything, but because it's sex, I was listening. The next day I'd tell all my friends, oh my God, you won't believe what my mom said last night. Most of my friends now say the majority of their sex ed came from my mom through me. When you're talking about sex, they're hearing. And so sometimes it means getting in the car without, you know, any devices and just taking a drive and talking and just really creating environments where you can just talk. And if they're, you want them to feel comfortable asking questions, and it's almost like a biological mandate that you know that you're not supposed to want to talk to your parents about this. It's your way of saying, I'm growing up, I'm separating, I don't need you anymore. This is one of the major ways teens are separating from their parents is around sexuality. And so they don't want to seem like they need you, but they do, they still are listening. And also talking to them when they're young. When we're in the classroom and we are talking to fourth graders, fifth graders, they will ask everything. When we're talking to older kids, that's where the more embarrassment comes in. And they're like, they feel like they should already know it, or that they're going to stand out if they ask it. And so if you can start talking younger, then they're more likely to get those questions answered. I was having a girls group with different ages, and we were talking about consent and healthy relationships and sexuality. And there was one girl who had a question. She's like, she kept raising her hand and then saying, oh, no, never mind. And then the older girls were saying, who had been in the group for a longer time, they were saying, no, it's so important that you get your questions answered. You have to ask your questions. And they were encouraging her to ask their questions. And that was so powerful to see, because they had been in this for so long, they had really come to understand the importance of asking your questions, of getting your questions answered, and not letting that any feelings of shame or embarrassment prevent you from having these conversations.
Yeah, that's great. What a nice setting to have a group where they can talk freely and openly. I mean, I think as parents, that's what we're really aiming for, if we can, to just create a space where our kids can have a dialogue with us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's so powerful. It's so powerful for them to have the space and really feel empowered to have their questions answered and own this information as their own, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess I feel concerned about parents who maybe just lecture when they do have these conversations, instead of, like you're saying, allow the child, the adolescent, to own part of the conversation, to ask the questions, even have an opinion, right?
And if you open up this conversation, it very well could be that your child says something outrageously horrible that scares you half to death, right? And you have to just roll with it. I mean, first of all, they're trying to do that probably just to make you stop talking to them. And they can, you know, there's a lot going on there. Plus, their generation has been raised thinking about, you know, intimacy and privacy and all of that completely different than the generation before them, mostly because of the internet. So they might say things that you find outrageous. If you act out outraged, they'll never talk to you again. So, you know, obviously when you're talking to a fifth grader or a sixth grader, you have a lot more leverage. They're so happy somebody's telling them something because they know they're going to need this stuff and they're really wanting information, so they will listen to you. By the time they're in seventh and eighth grade, they're like, you know, no, please stop, you know, and they're going to try to, you know, play a little bit. And that's okay. Just keep talking. Because it gives them some ground, you know. One of the things I'll say to parents, because parents bring this up so much, it's agonizing sometimes for them. Not for every parent, but for some, totally agonizing. And I'll say, just how, you know? And I said, listen, and this actually gets back to the course that we do in terms of the importance that we put on learning how to self-reflect and figure out who you are as a young person. But I will tell moms or dads to say, listen, I know you don't want to hear this, you know, this is terrible, horrible, the worst day of your life. I get all of that. But at the end of the day, I have to look in the mirror and know that I've done the best job I can do as your parent. That's my job. And the fact that it made you unhappy is not as relevant as the fact that it's making me feel proud of myself, or I've done what I think is the best I can do today. And all of us have that responsibility. You look in the mirror at the end of your day and you have to feel good about yourself. I have to feel good about myself. So you got to sit down and you got to listen to what I have to say, because I'm not going to bed tonight without you hearing. And just, you know, own it. As a parent, own it. Own it that that's your job. And there's no question. It's just going to happen.
Yeah. And I think in the end, I think children respect that. Even if it is uncomfortable.
And they'll be wretched. But a teenager, they're supposed to be kind of wretched. We cannot be that influenced by that. We can't let that stop us. It's just like part of the job, you know?
That's a great message. I love that you said that. What do we do if our children get really negative messages about sexuality or love, relationships? How do we counteract some of these negative messages?
I think the first thing we say is to be proactive. You want to talk to them, as we said, when they're young, so that they have your voice in their head before they start seeing all these messages. And that doesn't always work out the way you hope it would. So it's really important to use those examples as starting off points for having conversations. You know, don't, like, when you're looking at whether it's a show on TV that you're hearing about or a movie, it's a great way to start these conversations, because stories are so much more powerful than a lecture. So if you're having have a story, talk about, oh, what do you think they should have done? Or I feel this way, what do you think? Or I wonder why they made that decision. Let these be examples that can start a great conversation between you and your child.
The other part is too, is that being a young person, you're trying to figure out who you are. And core to the curriculum that we teach and to how we talk to parents is that a child has to have time for self-reflection. They have to be able to be with their own thoughts and figure out how they think and feel about things. And we start, and unless the decisions that you're making about sex or anything else comes from us understanding of yourself, you're just going to go along with whatever is happening. And that's like all the likes and all the, you know, the streaks on Snapchat, and everything is just kind of a collective wave of doing what everybody else is doing because it's too scary not to. But you counteract that by teaching a child how to self-reflect and have time with their own thoughts. And it's core to our curriculum. We start the whole curriculum and kids are like, this doesn't have anything to do about sex. What are we talking about this for? You know, but we literally give them an exercise to do at the very beginning, and they have to sustain it throughout the curriculum. They have to do something for 5 minutes every day. And we have a whole conversation about this leading up to it, where it's like, think of one thing that you do that when you're doing it, you feel like this is me, like this, this is really me. And it's different for different people because we're all so very different, and you're kind of like in that zone of yourself. Right. And for some kids, it's like
dribbling a basketball. For some, it's just doodling in a notebook just for themselves, not for any project. Or
for others, you know, playing music, but not for a recital, but for just because they're loving the music. A time when you're not, it wouldn't be like reading a book because that's putting yourself in someone else's head. You know, it wouldn't be doing a video game. That's putting yourself in another world. This is time just alone with your own thoughts. Mm-hmm. And we give them ideas of how to do that. We also have them generate lots of ideas of things they already do that are like that. We find, unfortunately, that most kids are kept so busy they never have time to do that, or they're like, I don't have 5 minutes to do this. What am I gonna do? I would say, just lay in bed at the end of the day, look up at the ceiling, and just think about your thoughts. Just listen to your own thoughts. Mm-hmm. For the length of the curriculum, we ask them, after they've done this for 5 minutes, they then write down, they kind of honor that by writing down what the experience was like. And at the very end of the curriculum, we ask them to write a letter that starts, dear best friend, this is what I know about you, right? And they're writing it to themselves. And they're very precious things. I mean, they get to keep them. Sometimes we get to see them. As a child develops, that letter would change and grow. But throughout the whole curriculum, whether we're talking about, you know, consent or healthy relationships or the, you know, penises and vaginas or all of that, we're always scrolling back to, how do you know about you? How do you know how you think about things? You know, we're asking them to be the research scientists of their own travel through adolescence. How do you know what, you know, how do you understand you? Because if you come from that place, all the rest of your decisions are going to be good. Yeah. They're based on you.
And this is important both for being able to make decisions that are true to yourself and know what decisions you want to make, but also to have the capacity to follow through and trust that you will follow through on the decisions that you make, that you will act on those decisions. And it's also really been powerful in our conversations around consent as well. Another story from a girls group is we were talking about consent. This was with younger girls, and we were talking about it as it applies to all forms of physical touch. And one girl said, I understand what consent is, but if I said no, wouldn't that hurt his feelings? And it led to such an important conversation about how often as girls, we are taught to prioritize a man's feelings and desires over our own. But we need to also own our own feelings, own our own desires. And that all starts with our relationship with self and really respecting how you feel about things. And then you can think about how are you going to communicate that kindly to someone else. But you've got to first know how you feel and really prioritize that.
In the group, when you're talking about that, if they have been introduced to this idea of this letter, dear best friend, this is what I know about you, then you can say, why would you care about his feelings more than you care about your own feelings? Like, you have to know what you want, what you feel about this situation, because otherwise you're not being nice to your very best friend, which is yourself, you know? So, I mean, that making that connection, we go back to self-reflection over and over and over again throughout the curriculum, because, you know, it's very hard when you have this in your hand 24 hours a day, and you're always
the cell phone.
The cell phone. And you're always trying to be busy, and you're always trying to look like something very important is happening. You don't have time to know what your own thoughts are. You know, nobody's given you that space and that time to know your own thoughts. So yeah, that's a huge part of it.
That's wonderful. I mean, it's, I think all of these activities you're talking about just reinforce this idea of internal validation instead of external validation. And that's so much more, you know, powerful and long lasting.
Yeah. You're creating your own identity in adolescence and you're judging yourself against your peers, obviously, and all of that. But now you have several things. Not only are you constantly assessing yourself when you're with your peers, you're constantly assessing yourself when you're not with your peers based on so many different, very controlled and manipulated environments that are only there to keep you assessing yourself based on other people's ideas and feelings. They're not there to ever support you in figuring out how you feel about anything, right? And that's the kind of the tragic moment-to-moment life of a teen these days is so much controlled by that. And parents need to hear that.
And they're so vulnerable to it. I mean, for so many reasons. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, so much of what you're saying, kind of creating this space where you can think about your own thoughts, your own identity, those sorts of things. It reminds me of, you know, my own research, which is in mindfulness and sexuality. What is the connection that you see between the work you do with sex education and mindfulness?
It's fascinating because we talk about this a lot. This idea of self-reflection, first of all, developing self to those moments when you are just with yourself and with your own thoughts. I think of mindfulness as being, you know, being present in the moment and being aware of everything. To me, that connects more with how we understand self-control and self-discipline. And like when we give our curriculum, there are three skill sets that we tell parents kids need to be healthy sexual people. One is self-reflection, that capacity on a regular basis. One is self-control. And the other is good communication, those three aspects. Mm-hmm. I think of mindfulness as being an awareness that, it's so funny, it goes back to my private practice too. It's like, you'll make the connection, I'm sure, but a mother once called me that I hadn't seen her kid in years. And she called me and she says, "I just had to tell you, the best thing you ever said to me is it's not my job to make my child happy." You know, and I think of that when I think of mindfulness, because if you're walking around thinking that you're supposed to be very happy all the time, you have no capacity to live in the world as it is. And you're going to make such tragic mistakes because you're always going after the next little piece of pleasure that you can have, as opposed to something that's more joyful that comes from being able to hold your own thoughts and be comfortable when things aren't comfortable. You know, and know that this is life. I define myself by what I choose and by what I don't choose. And sometimes there's displeasure involved or so I'm not happy. Mm-hmm. And I sit there and look at that and say, this also defines me. This moment also defines me. The fact that I can not act on something that everybody's doing or it's going to be great, but I can just sit there and feel the discomfort of being myself in this moment, just myself. I see that as the connection to the skill set of mindfulness, which is so relevant in the world that we're living in right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty powerful what you just said. I think that being able to sit with discomfort or even growth, right? Growth can be painful. And so if we can't tolerate the discomfort of being uncomfortable while we grow, while we learn, while we figure out who we are, that's really going to create some disadvantage in how we develop as an adolescent, but also as an adult.
So much, this is a huge part of when we talk to teens about social media and smartphones is how we look at different scenarios and they themselves should say, whenever they have a moment of discomfort, the cell phone's the solution. You know, they don't ever have to face that discomfort or work through it so that they can grow. They just take out the cell phone and they're distracted and they never have to face that situation. It's really changing how teens are learning to engage in this world. They don't like this about their lives. They want to have another reality, but they literally have a supercomputer pointed at their brain that's telling them to go on, to go check a notification all the time. So their ability to just sit in discomfort and work through it is greatly diminished.
When we give, what Chelsea's talking about with the scenarios is very important because we'll give them real life kinds of situations where someone might be, you know, wanting to flirt or be, you know, attracted to somebody else. They're very uptight. They're very anxious. So in the moment when they have the capacity to be feeling all of these feelings because the person is right there with them, instead of doing that, they'll pick up their phone and they'll, you know, do this because they're so, you know, but what, and then, you know, the questions that we'll ask is, well, how are they going to develop the capacity to communicate. I mean, how are they ever going to get past that? You know, how are they ever going to learn how to say something if they're always distracting themselves? And you'll see these kids put down their phones like, yeah, you know, like this is we're really being manipulated to never face any kind of discomfort of any kind. Or God forbid, boredom, you know, any kind of boredom or discomfort.
Right.
They don't know how to use it effectively. Grown-ups don't know how to use it effectively, but they're actually developing into, you know, adult humans with adult responsibilities without capacities that they're going to need.
Yeah. And if they, you know, behave badly in some situation and something pricks them, right? They know they behaved badly. And yet that self-reflection can be so easily derailed if we just numb it ourselves with entertainment or, you know, checking out what people, how other people view us, instead of really just self-evaluating what we did and maybe how we could do better.
Exactly.
Yeah, there, growth comes from discomfort, you know, it really does. And you're working it out. And if you take away all discomfort, and I think that's why the parent says, you, the best thing is telling me that it wasn't my job to make my child happy, because then the child can grow. The parent becomes aligned with that as well. You know, by constantly giving a young child everything that they want exactly when they want it, there's no sense that I can spend a minute feeling uncomfortable and live through it. You know what I mean? We do that often. That's part of a consumer culture that we're living in as well. Like, we just find the next thing to make us happy.
What would you say to encourage adolescents to kind of develop this muscle of self-discipline or, you know, reflectiveness?
I mean, we have all kinds of things that we ask them to do in the class. We actually talk about self-control as one of the most vital parts of being a human. And we ask them, you know, how they're going to do that and what they think the importance of it is. And we ask them to pick something that they can do and to feel that feeling of discomfort and see what that's like. So we give them, you know, and they pick their own things and they see the value, you know, they can see the value of it. It's something that comes up in my private practice all the time. And you can't just, it's not an easy answer. You have to lead someone to understanding what you're talking about. I think mindfulness training is just a really great way because I think it cuts through a lot of it. Sitting with your own, I mean, how many times have we had kids when we get asked them to do a self-reflection exercise and they're like, it's too scary to be with my own thoughts. It's too scary. You know, I mean, Lord, you know. All the more reason. Let's see what's in there. It's okay. You know, when you're a therapist with someone and you're working with someone like that, you know, you take a long time to kind of pull that apart and unravel that and have them feel safe with whatever's going on inside there. When you're teaching it as a class, I think, you know, meditation, mindfulness exercise, all of that becomes very valuable.
And having time away from the phone. And I think parents need to model that. Parents need to show that there's times in the day, places in the home that we don't have devices and that we can have conversations. And then kids can learn how to have those conversations with themselves, even when they're very young.
I had a dad once telling me about how when his, like, it was like 4 or 5 year old daughter would go to sleep at night, he would come in and he would say, so tell me about your day. What was it like? And then how did you feel about that? And then what did you do next? You know, and then she would just ramble through her day with him and that would be it. But he was asking her basically to self-reflect on everything that had happened that day. And he was the ear. He was the listener. Anyway, one evening he got tied up and didn't get up there at the normal time. So she'd been in bed for a while. And so when he approached the room, he could hear her talking out loud to herself. And he stood by the door and listened. And she was out loud just saying everything that had happened to her that day. And then I did this, and then I did that. And then, you know, it was, and basically that's a powerful tool to be given to a child. You know, you know, if world religions have incorporated this, the importance of this into a lot of what they do, the self-control, it's in many different ways you can see it. I love to study different religions and just see how they pull out some of these things. But self-reflection, for sure. You know, there are little kids that are taught to talk to God all the time. And like, who are you talking to? You know, I mean, it's like you're engaging, understanding yourself through somebody who is listening to you and you're explaining and thinking through everything. You know, that is a powerful way to begin that as well. If you're a religious person, if you're not a religious person, just be the mirror that just listens and reflects back what the child's saying. That skill is almost like an armor for them. You know, they know who they are and they go out into the world now with that understanding. It's very powerful.
Yeah, I love that. I love that, religious or not, this skill of reflection, of self-reflection, is so important to our growth, to our development, to just making sense of our daily life. Exactly. And I love the story you told, how the father really taught this from a really young age. So this little girl had that pattern in her life.
She'll always lay in bed at night and think through her day. That'll always be how she approaches the world. And that is gold. That is golden.
That is. Any last thoughts, any other words of wisdom the two of you could give us? First of all, I just want to say, I love watching the dynamic between the two of you. How fun that a mother and daughter can openly talk about this in, you know, such a positive way and do so much good for other people as well. But last words of wisdom that you might have.
Thank you for saying that. I think that's really our goal, is opening up these conversations between generations, between parents and children. The most important thing we can do in our work is supporting parents and supporting children and opening up these conversations, because so much of what we see as I've studied this is there's just generational shame that's passed down from generation to generation. And our goal is to break that pattern. And by opening up these conversations, we can do that.
I mean, the reason why we insist on talking to parents, and the reason why we send kids back during the course to talk to their parents and ask their parents questions, is because there is no sex ed. The kids are so excited when you teach sex ed. It's like, but maybe 10% comes through, right? If we can get the parents to start talking, that is assurance for the kid's whole life. Even if the parent botches it terribly, it's still golden for the child to be able to know that they have someone that they can go to and talk to, and that this isn't something that they can only find out about in the dark under the covers, you know, with their little, you know, smartphones, you know, that they can actually talk to people who care about them and want them to be healthy and happy sexual people.
Yeah, I love that message to the parents, really, that you're a critical part of this. Even if your kids go and take a super class, they're not going to retain, and their life is going to change from year to year. So they need that constant guidance. And your model is just so perfect. You help parents understand you don't have to be perfect to do this. You don't have to have all the right vocabulary. Just dig in and start opening up these conversations. Thank you so much for being with me. This has been a real treat for me to learn from you and to learn more about your program. Can you give us just verbally, and then we will put your information on this podcast as well, but maybe you'll just say if you have a website or how people could get more information about what you do.
Yeah, we have the website. It's www.maxwelled.com. So that's MaxwellED.com. And
wonderful.
We have all our information about parent student courses on there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care. Good talking to you.
That's it for this week. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Sexual Mindfulness Project, and subscribe to our website, shalomlevitt.com, to stay up to date with the latest information on sexual mindfulness. Thanks for listening.